From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're learning more today about that attack at Istanbul's airport that killed dozens and injured hundreds and is provoking disturbing questions about whether anything could have been done to stop the attack and whether airports can be made safer. In the Turkey massacre, there was reportedly first a gun attack in a parking lot near a terminal at Atatürk Airport, which drew security away from the crowded drop-off area, where a suicide bomber then set off a bomb that killed scores, but also allowed a third bomber inside the terminal. He was tackled by a brave guard before he set off his suicide belt. Fran Townsend is a former Homeland Security advisor. She's now executive vice president at an investment firm, McAndrews & Forbes. And Fran, after the Brussels attack, people did harden security at airport entrances. This is what they did in Turkey, at the door. But as we're hearing, that security was drawn away by a diversion.
That's right. And I think what we know now is ISIS in particular and terror groups more generally have this penchant for soft targets. And every time we harden them, so in the example of Turkey, they do have a preliminary screening right as you come in through the main door. And every time you harden and push out your preliminary screening point, they find another vulnerability. The Turkish response, the law enforcement response there, was incredibly quick. The numbers could have been much worse.
It could have been much worse. But still, you know, this is perplexing because this was the discussion again after Brussels. Well, move the security back from what I guess you security people call the air side. You know, the security checkpoint is more on the side of where the airplanes are. Move it back to the, you know, the entrance to the terminal. But then you create these crowds of people waiting to get through that security who are then vulnerable.
That's true. And one of the things, you know, the United States has worried about that vulnerability for some time. I remember even when I was in government, there are security folks in that pre-screening area, certainly in the United States, trying to identify people before they're sort of inside an area where folks are most vulnerable. But, you know, you have to come to grips with the idea in a free and open society and public spaces, they're never 100% secure. You can take these measures to mitigate the risk, but you're never going to get it to zero. I think what you're going to find now, as we understand after Brussels and Paris and now Istanbul, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, looking at these soft targets as the alternative to the big 9/11 style attack, we're going to have to re-examine what is our security policy vis-a-vis soft targets. Will we consider having metal detectors and that sort of thing before you go into a mall? There is a renewed debate about how do we better mitigate the risk against soft targets, terrorist attacks.
I don't mean to interrupt, but then you come up with the same problem. If you've got people backed up, and we see it now at, you know, when they have concerts at Fenway Park here in Boston, which is normally a sports park, there are often security checkpoints, but that backs people up into these crowds waiting to get in. So you've created a vulnerable crowd of people outside the stadium when they might have flowed freely inside and you wouldn't have had that backup.
That's right. But the risk on the other side is you have them in an enclosed area where the blast effect of a bomb inside an enclosed area is more lethal. And so these are constant trade-offs. I do think if you're going to have a screening point where you have people queued up and vulnerable, you also have to take steps to mitigate and try to protect them. The other piece to this is the intelligence and making sure your entire effort is intelligence-driven so you're not relying on that very last point of screening.
Yeah, investing money and efforts into finding them before they get to the airport. Fran Townsend, she's a former Homeland Security advisor. Fran, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, today, British Prime Minister David Cameron took questions in the House of Commons about Britain's impending exit from the EU. He was also asked about Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, also against Brexit, who lost a confidence vote yesterday but shows no signs of resigning. Here's Cameron.
Look, if he's looking for excuses about why the side he and I were on about the referendum, frankly, he should look somewhere else. And I have to say to the Honourable Gentleman, he talks about job insecurity and my 2 months to go. It might be in my party's interest for him to sit there. It's not in the national interest. And I would say, for heaven's sake, man, go.
Well, Cameron did not join other European leaders meeting in Brussels today, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel said efforts to reverse the Brexit would be near impossible. But Gideon Rockman of the Financial Times says he doesn't believe Brexit will happen. He joins us via Skype from London. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I have to say, you wrote this piece before both Angela Merkel and David Cameron spoke yesterday and said, no, this is what's happening. Do you still think that a Brexit is avoidable?
I certainly think it's avoidable. I don't think it's at all inevitable that we'll leave. But I think you have to understand the pretty firm positions that came out of the European Council meeting in Brussels last night, where everyone said, yeah, this is it, as just the beginning of a process. The vote took place last week. It's maybe 5 days away now. This process of divorce, even for those who want it to happen fast, is going to take at least 2 years. So I think it's possible, maybe even likely, that we will extricate ourselves from this, but it's not going to be easy.
Well, and one of the things that people who agree with you have said is that David Cameron did not immediately invoke Article 50, which is the legal process by which the UK would leave the European Union, and that it's going to be much harder down the road, especially after all the negative headlines that have come out of this, for the next prime minister to actually do that. I mean, in October, we're going to have heard for months about all the problems with the Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, that is true to some extent. But there's a further issue, which is that I think even many people on the Leave campaign want to delay invoking Article 50 because it has a 2-year deadline. And their fear is that as soon as we in Britain do that, we lose a whole lot of leverage because the Europeans can just run the clock down and we end up with a lousy deal. So they want to start talking before we invoke Article 50, get a kind of framework deal in place, and then do it. However, the question is, will the Europeans tolerate that? At the moment, it doesn't look like they will. And meanwhile, voters are going to be very confused. They're going to say to the British government, hang on, we just voted to leave the EU. Like, why are you not going ahead with it?
Well, and when you use the term negotiation and leverage, I want to listen to, in that context, Nigel Farage, who's one of the big boosters of the Brexit campaign. He's the head of the UKIP party. Here he was yesterday at the European Parliament. He was laughed at. He was booed when he talked about what he would like to see happen. Let's listen.
Let's cut between us a sensible tariff free deal, and thereafter recognize that the United Kingdom will be your friend, that we will trade with you, we will cooperate with you, we will be your best friends in the world. But do that, do it sensibly, and allow us to go off and pursue our global ambitions and future. Thank you.
So when I hear that, Gideon Rockman, I hear somebody trying to negotiate for all the good parts of the EU that everybody likes. And when I hear Merkel and other European leaders say, nope, you've got to get out. If this is what you want, then just get out. I hear, in a sense, they're negotiating as well. They're saying, look, if this is what you really want, you're not going to get any of the good parts, even if later they may come back and say, OK, fine, you can have them.
Yeah, I mean, those are the opening positions, and they're very, very hard to reconcile at the moment. But everybody's making a calculation of where their interests lie. Now, of course, the British interests in a way are easier to define. We, as you say, want the good parts. We want the free trade. We don't want the free movement of people. And we don't want the supremacy of European Union law. The European interest is harder to define because you could argue it either that they have an interest in being absolutely uncompromising with us, because they worry that if Britain makes a success of leaving the EU, other countries will leave the EU. However, I think there's also an argument that it's actually not in their interests, maybe, to turn their fire on Britain, so to speak, because Britain is an important player in Europe. It's a big economy. It's the second or first largest military force in the EU. It's a major diplomatic player. It's on the UN Security Council. And generally, the EU's rhetoric is about creating peace and understanding in Europe. My hope is that as over the course of the next year or two, people calm down and they move back towards the more cooperative route. But I don't think there's a guarantee of that.
So going back to your original idea in the Financial Times, the headline, I do not believe Brexit will happen. How will we know in the coming months if what you have laid out is coming true?
I don't think we will know in the coming months. It may take a couple of years. I think that basically what I hope will happen, and the way I think it's happened with other countries rejecting EU treaties in referenda, Denmark in 1992, Ireland over the Lisbon and Nice treaties, that when people have a little time to assimilate the shock, they see a way around it. They negotiate a new deal. they have a second referendum, and the problem is got around. That is the way to do it, because this was not an overwhelming vote to leave the EU. It was 52 to 48%, right, which is means that all you need is a 2% shift in the UK for us to stay. And it is not hard to imagine at least a 2% shift, given the fact that the people who campaigned for leave told everyone there would be no economic consequences. And we now see that, in fact, economic, really quite grave economic consequences are unfolding. So on the other hand, I think that if the Europeans adopt a very uncompromising situation, they'll more or less force us out of the door because of this kind of mutual recriminations that will set in. However, if they cool down and if the Brits handle it skillfully, they might be able to find this middle ground compromise that allows us in a couple of years' time to say to the British, OK, do you want to reconsider? And I think at that point, if they were presented with a viable and face-saving option, they would take it.
That's Gideon Rachman of the Financial Times joining us from London. Gideon, thank you.
My pleasure.
In Turkey, dozens were killed in that airport attack, but well over 200 people survived with injuries. Here in the U.S., there were dozens, more than 50, wounded survivors of the Orlando nightclub shooting. Eight remain hospitalized. Collectively, they've endured more than 70 surgeries so far. Today, we want to take a moment with survivors. What will survivors' lives be like? Well, our next guests can make an educated guess. Emery Hochhalter was a 17-year-old student at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado in 1999, eating lunch outside when she was hit by two bullets. She is now a paraplegic using a wheelchair. She joins us by Skype from Colorado. Emery, thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
And Derek O'Dell was a student at Virginia Tech in 2007 when the shooter entered his classroom. Derek was struck in the arm, but he scrambled over desks and then with a friend held the door shut. Twice the shooter tried to re-enter. Derek held on. 32 were killed that day. More certainly would have been had he and a friend not barricaded that door. Derek joins us now from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke, Virginia. Derek, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Emery, I want to start with you because I'm not sure if we should add another victim to the Columbine shootings, because I understand that 6 months after the shootings, you write about how depression runs in your family. But 6 months after the shootings, your mother killed herself. Was it because of Columbine?
Columbine certainly didn't help her, yeah. But she had really bad depression for 3 years before that. And then Columbine happened, and that was just the final straw yeah. for her. It didn't directly cause it, but yeah. it certainly didn't help her.
Well, and it couldn't have helped you,
know.
And so we're so sorry. But, you know, you have achieved so much struggling through such terrible pain. So tell us, what happens to you, and I'm going to ask Derek as well, when then you have the Orlando shooting?
Well, for me, I immediately get taken back to April 20th. I get memories, I get flashbacks, and then I also get really upset because the people that were impacted by the Orlando shootings are now part of a club that no one wants to belong to. I just feel for them because I know a little bit about what they're going through. I don't know exactly because the circumstances were different, but we both were impacted by a crazy person with a gun.
Well, and Derek, I know that you'd be the first to say that your injury was nowhere near what Anne-Marie's was, but you suffered the psychological and emotional aftermath we'd expect, struggled with PTSD, I understand. So what happens for you when you hear about Orlando?
Yeah, for me, certainly the mental injuries are more severe than the physical ones. And every time one of these shootings happens, whether it's in a public place or a school, certainly it brings back memories from Virginia Tech for me personally. But just like Anne-Marie said, more shifts towards, more people become part of this club, unfortunately. And
yeah.
Feeling for them as they go through everything that we have.
Yeah, so it recharges the feelings that you went through. And, I mean, you fought for your life and saved your life and other lives. You've said that talking about this helps, and so we want to tell listeners that. We're not, forcing you certainly to do this. But what can the Orlando survivors expect? Is it the sounds? Is it the smells? What is it?
I think for each individual person, it's different. For Orlando, it wasn't in a school, it was in a nightclub, and, you know, you're enjoying your night out, and you don't expect to see this happen. Right. So it destroys your sense of security, not only for them going forward, but also it makes you reevaluate every single place that you go in your life and evaluate an escape plan, and definitely brings back memories in terms of the gunpowder and the smells and the sights and sounds from the shooting that occurred at Virginia Tech, but also the mental anguish that everybody feels after the shootings, both personally and all those families and survivors and victims that get affected by this shooting.
Yeah.
So having to deal with that again and, you know, reaching out to some of the fellow survivors from Virginia Tech helps me personally in terms of dealing with my own mental anguish after each shooting occurs.
Also, you do speak with other survivors from Virginia Tech.
Yeah, Virginia Tech did a fantastic job creating a group or an outreach of all the survivors. I think that's one of the best things that hopefully with Orlando that those victims can set up for themselves, is because everybody knows what each individual person has gone through.
Same thing here happened here in Boston. The survivors of the marathon bombing very much function as one organism. You know, it's sort of a one for all for one. They make decisions together, and they say that's helped them. And Anne-Marie, I mentioned how Derek fought for his life. You did too, in a way, because first responders thought you were dead, and you managed to raise a hand. You know, that probably saved your life. But now, from our understanding, you live in constant pain that you have to manage. Isn't that a constant reminder of that day?
Yes, it is. I was actually shot twice. The first bullet was the one that paralyzed me, but the second bullet, it ripped through all of my internal organs. So that's the one that really was really life-threatening. And I barely saw the ambulance when it pulled up, and they were prepared to move on. And so I did reach out my hand. But with a spinal cord injury from a gunshot wound, it does create oftentimes a really, really large amount of nerve pain. And it is a reminder. I mean, the wheelchair is a reminder too, but the nerve pain, it just seems to be getting worse with every passing year. I just do the best I can to try to manage it. So hard.
You know, your thoughts on that, because maybe people in the Colorado area are aware of this, but I don't think many of us really think about the fact that there are people in wheelchairs across the country and living with PTSD, and there's hundreds of them at this point. I don't think we check in with them enough.
Yeah, there are so many people. From the Aurora Theater shootings, there were a lot of people that had long-lasting injuries. Our lives are permanently impacted, both emotionally, of course, but also physically in a lot of cases.
Are you in touch with Columbine? So long ago, you're all in your 30s. Are you in touch? I mean, you have school reunions, huh?
We do have Facebook, and so that's almost like a school reunion. And so a lot of us do keep in contact, and we band together when the anniversary comes around or when there's another shooting, because we know how it impacts us. And I've reached out to a lot of people in other shootings, especially Aurora, because that was local. And I'm also here for any of the people that were impacted in Orlando. You can message me on Facebook. I'm here for you.
Hmm. Derek, what else would you say that you know that someone might use in moving forward? Now, you were able to go back to Virginia Tech the following semester. You finished your studies. You went on to a veterinary degree. But what would you say?
I think it's the reality of the situation now. More people are getting to know somebody that's been affected by a mass shooting than not knowing. And for me personally, having a great family and friend network, at the time my girlfriend was at Virginia Tech, and now we're married, and having her by my side and my family and friends has helped me recover through all of this. And even when these terrible tragedies happen every year, every month.
As much as you can, a sense of normalcy. And Anne-Marie, you wrote a letter on Facebook to one of the shooter's mothers. She'd written a book, and she said that all the proceeds were going to go to support people with mental health issues. You wrote about how you appreciated that. That would have been wonderful for your mother. You also wrote, interestingly, that a good friend once told you, bitterness is like swallowing a poison pill and expecting the other person to die. So you write, I've forgiven you. How much does forgiveness help?
Well, it's freeing. It's liberating. She had written me a letter about 6 months after that I was injured, saying how sorry she was and that she asked for my forgiveness. And so I let her know that I had forgiven her.
Because you couldn't at the time, right? You couldn't at the time.
Well, it was only 6 months after.
Right,
so,
right.
I mean, everything was still so fresh. And then I put the letter away. And then when I heard her book come out, I had to write her and let her know, because there were a lot of families that were very upset with her for doing this. And I wanted to let her know that not everyone felt that way. I do believe that bitterness is like a swallowing a poison pill and expecting the other person to die. It only harms yourself.
Yeah. And Derek, just to that point, though, that I mean, I'm wondering if that's another point you'd make, that it's never over.
Exactly. There's constant reminders, you know, whether it's physical wounds or like Anne Marie's felt in terms of worsening pain over the years. But at the same time, I think focusing on that you're here. So many of the people that have died in these shootings probably would trade places for you in a heartbeat. So making sure that you focus on that you're here and that you can do everything with your life now and try to the best that you can in the current capacity that you're in. You know, so often there's survivor's guilt knowing that you have survived this and other people didn't. But in talking with a bunch of the families that had lost children and family members at Virginia Tech, it's amazing how much they kind of move on through watching the victims move on as well. I continue on with my life and what I love, my passions being veterinary medicine and being with my family. It's an important part for me.
Oh, doing it because they can't.
Derek, I definitely agree with you. It was so interesting what you said about how the people who have lost their loved ones are kind of living vicariously through the survivors' lives. That actually happened in my case because I became very close with Rick and Sue Townsend. Mm-hmm. They lost their daughter, Lauren, in the library that day. And we have become very, very, very close. So good can come out of it. And having a good support system is key, like you said.
That's Anne Marie Hochhalter, a survivor of the Columbine shootings, paraplegic who lives and very actively lives in a wheelchair, and Derek O'Dell, a survivor of the Virginia Tech shootings in 2007. Thank you both so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
It strikes us that while battling pain every day, Anne Marie helps police carry out active shooter trainings. And Derek has said he's finally gotten over the guilt that while he saved many, he couldn't save more. But he is uncomfortable with being called a hero. And today, Ottawa hosts the Three Amigos, as they call themselves, the leaders of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, who are in the Canadian capital for the meeting of countries in the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which yesterday, in his speech on trade, Donald Trump said he'd rewrite.
I'm going to tell our NAFTA partners that I intend to immediately renegotiate the terms of that agreement to get a better deal. By a lot, not just a little, by a lot for our workers.
Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. And Kurt, I'm thinking we could do an hour on this, but let's just have a review here since it's in the news. NAFTA, first suggested by Ronald Reagan. Why and what has been its impact?
Well, this was at a time that there were rising free trade zones. Ironically, today with some of the Brexit news, the European Union was really getting off the ground. It was adopting a new currency. It was a free trade zone
no
that
tariffs,
was growing.
You don't get charged to trade. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. You take down kind of the transaction cost of doing business across borders. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was to make North America its own free trade region. And the impact was really heavily debated at that time. It still is today. Really, the best research says that the impact overall has been relatively flat, that it hasn't led to tremendous growth, like proponents of the free trade deal said it would at the time, but that it also hasn't led to the doomsday scenario that opponents warned against. That said, that's an overall impact. There has been a very uneven impact across cities, across workers, across industries, across the country.
Yeah, we remind ourselves that sometimes the example is given that, yes, you know, a lot of trade has gone to China, for instance, or a lot of manufacturing has gone to China, but it makes it less expensive for us to buy some Chinese goods or things made in China, like smartphones or devices. So, you know, people are losing jobs, but we're buying things. But both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were critical of NAFTA when they were running for president in 2008.
Yeah, so this gets back to the idea that a lot of jobs would go to Mexico, that factories would go to Mexico, and some certainly did. On the other hand, there were benefits to consumers of lower prices, but the larger sort of business impact is that a lot of U.S. companies were able to have a more globalized, better supply chain, manufacture their goods better and more cheaply so that they were more competitive selling their goods, not only in this region, but around the country.
Well, then we have the bigger trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. that would largely replace NAFTA if passed, if passed is key there. So does that make NAFTA kind of, you know, maybe a little more irrelevant?
No, NAFTA is still relevant because it's a campaign issue now. It's also something that people refer to whether or not they'll even ratify the TPP if it's signed and comes before the Senate.
Look, we're hearing that NAFTA is in some ways getting a bad rap, that industry manufacturing is changing anyway. Factories are far more computerized. There were not that many jobs. What does the business community make of this anti-trade sentiment?
Well, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says that this is going to cost 3.5 million jobs. The National Association of Manufacturers also criticized Trump. And really, business leaders are saying, look, look at what Great Britain did. They decided to get out of a free trade zone. Now they're headed for a recession. That if you hit the button to blow up a free trade deal, you're not actually hitting the undo button on globalization. You're actually hitting the self-destruct button.
Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, with a review of what's in the news today, NAFTA. Kurt, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
60 years ago today, President Dwight Eisenhower signed the Federal Highway Act of 1956. It was the birth of the interstate highway system, a 47,000-mile network designed to ease crowded, crumbling roads in post-war America. At the time, it was pitched as one of the most ambitious public works projects ever.
Most of these roads will be 4, 6, even 8-lane expressways constructed for through traffic. They will take the over-the-road driver from city to city, coast to coast, at highway speeds, even through large population centers.
Well, 60 years later, the interstates are overworked and under-maintained. And joining us now is Will Wilkins. He's the executive director of TRIP, the National Transportation Research Group that published a study this week on the state of American interstates. Will, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jeremy. A pleasure.
Well, and remind us about the vision, the original vision for the interstate system back in the 50s.
Well, perhaps it started when then-Lieutenant Dwight D. Eisenhower went on a convoy trip from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco in 1919. And that trip took 62 days. And I just looked on MapQuest yesterday to see what it would take to drive today, and that's about 45 hours. So he provided strong support for building it so that it would improve traffic safety, reduce travel times, and improve the nation's economic productivity. President Eisenhower also saw what the Autobahn did for Germany during World War II. And so when he signed that legislation in 1956, it was actually called the Dwight D. Eisenhower National System of Interstate and Defense Highways, so that it would also play a defensive role for us if there were any attack on the United States.
And at this point, the interstate highways carry about 25% of the vehicle traffic in this country, and the number of cars on the roads have gone up from 65 million to 260 million now. Were the people who planned the interstate highways expecting this kind of growth?
I don't think so. You know, I think the world has changed quite a bit since that vision in 1956. And our population has increased from 91% from roughly 168 million to 321 million today. So it's kind of hard to be able to project that kind of growth.
Which brings us to another thing that your report gets into and something that we hear about and report on a lot, which is that the maintenance situation, the backlog on these highways is very poor.
Well, the current backlog of needed improvements is roughly $189 billion. $59 billion is needed to improve pavement conditions, $30 billion to improve bridges, and another $100 billion for needed system expansion. And a lot of it is to the fact that the motor fuel tax is not keeping up with the needed repairs. It was last raised in 1983,
right,
and it's 18.4 cents. When the Interstate Act was passed, it was a 3-cent gas tax increase. And if you would have indexed that for inflation, that would be about 26 cents today. So we're not even letting our motor fuel tax keep up with needed repairs.
Several years ago, I drove from Los Angeles to New York and took the southern route across the country and then came up, you know, from Atlanta up through Washington, D.C. And one of the things I noticed was I didn't hit a single toll until I got to D.C., and then it was toll, 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 toll all the way up the East Coast. Why are there so many more tolls, seemingly, in the eastern part of the country than, you know, Los Angeles? You can drive around and never pay a toll.
Well, Los Angeles was famous for coining the phrase freeway.
Right.
Here in the East Coast, some of the highways that went into the interstate system were already toll roads, like the Pennsylvania Turnpike, the New York State Thruway. I think you're going to see more tolling in the future with the gas tax not being raised, because that's one way to improve the system. And I think you'll find that many of the toll roads are actually in better shape because they're raising enough money to make the needed repairs and improvements.
I have to, before I let you go, give a shout out to where I am in Boston and the Big Dig, which
right.
I know everyone hated while it was happening, but quite frankly, it's completely revitalized the entire downtown. And I wonder, do you think other cities are going to take that lesson and say, you know what, it's not easy to do, but doing it really provides great benefits for people to put the highway underground?
That is probably an ideal way to go, but right now, we're not spending enough just to maintain the system we have. So until there's some form of a motor fuels tax or some other sustainable form of funding for the Federal Highway Trust Fund, I think we're going to have a very difficult time just maintaining the system as it is today.
That's Will Wilkins, the executive director of TRIP, a National Transportation Research Group, joining us on the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Federal Highway Act of 1956 by President Dwight Eisenhower. Will Wilkins, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
And if you've ever driven on Interstate 95 in Florida, you may have noticed that Floridians like to go fast. Last year, almost 800,000 of them were ticketed for speeding. Wilson Sayre from Here Now contributor WLRN in Miami recently got pulled over, and she wanted to see if the traffic classes that people take to repair their records actually make them better drivers.
I was going 88 in a 70-mile-per-hour zone. A very nice officer decided I needed to be going a bit slower and gave me a ticket to that effect. So I was not really excited about the idea of my insurance rates going up. That's what usually happens when you get points on your license for bad driving. So to prevent that, I did what a lot of people do. I took a traffic class. You can take it online or in person. I took mine online.
Do you feel your skills are above?
Oh, yes. I'm the best driver in the world.
This is improv comedy traffic school.
We use humor to deliver a very important message.
This is Gary Alexander, the guy who started the school.
People who come through our classes are not novice drivers. Hopefully, by the end of the class, we reach at least every person, and they have this aha moment. Hey, you know, maybe I should put my seatbelt. Maybe I should slow down.
After the four-hour class, I passed the final test, 39 out of 40 questions right. But the next day, getting into my car, I had this big question. Was I somehow now a better driver? Are these classes actually effective?
They definitely are.
That's Ray Graves. He's the guy who oversees traffic classes in Florida. He's with the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles. They do periodic studies of these classes.
Basically, the study takes the group of individuals who have completed the course, and they look 18 months prior to their driving history and 18 months after, and compare that to a control group if the driver's driving record is better than the course is deemed effective.
In 2014, the department found all the traffic classes in Florida to be effective.
One of the things that people learn is not necessarily being a better driver, but how to avoid tickets.
Steve Block worked as a traffic safety researcher for AAA of Southern California. Block retired about a year ago, and he spent his career doing in-depth research on this stuff in California, but says it translates across the country. The Florida study took a group of people who completed the class and compared their driving to a section of the general population to see if there's any change. Block's California study found that the general population is different from people who take driving courses. So in order to compare apples to apples, Block had to find people who were actually going to take a traffic class. He partnered with the state and essentially set up fake classes.
People actually showed up for the class, you know, in the morning. Like, here I am. It's 9 o'clock. I'm ready to take the class. And we dismissed 3,000 people. Thank you for showing up. Go home.
Block gave the people passes saying they successfully completed the class, so they weren't ripped off. In return, he had their data. And months later, he compared the traffic records of people who were sent home to people who actually took the course. Using that method, again, Block found the classes to be pretty much ineffective. So maybe you're willing to pay $30 to take a class to mask the points on your license so your insurance doesn't go up. Awesome. Block says, not so awesome.
By systematically masking people's citations, the DMV doesn't know about those drivers who keep getting a lot of tickets and would have their licenses suspended or revoked.
And that, he says, makes our roads less safe. In Florida, you can only take a class 5 times in your life to mask a ticket, and only once in a given year. Block says that's the right direction, but doesn't do enough to deal with the statistical reality he found. Even though he's steeped in this research, the day he retired, he got pulled over for rolling through a stop sign.
I literally had my retirement cake in the back seat.
And Steve Block, just like the rest of us, ponied up, sat down, and took the traffic class. For Here and Now, I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
Vice President Joe Biden is at Howard University in D.C. today for a national summit on his $1 billion cancer moonshot initiative. Remember, in February, the White House announced a $195 million investment. Well, today, researchers, doctors, advocates, business leaders, patients, and cancer survivors have gathered to beat cancer.
I believe we can make exponential progress. Exponential progress. I firmly believe we can do in the next 5 years what would ordinarily take 10.
David Nather is Washington editor of our partner STAT. We have a weekly conversation about health and medicine. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And, well, we know you were at the Cancer Moonshot Summit. This is obviously a personal issue for Joe Biden. His son, Beau, died of brain cancer last year, 46 years old. But, you know, there was also some cynicism when this huge amount of money was announced. So what was the main takeaway today?
Well, the main thing Biden was trying to do is just rally everybody to work together. You know, all of the different people who are involved in the cancer community, researchers, government officials, patient advocates, industry people. And he was kind of saying, you know, stop paying attention to your turf. A lot of times he talks about silos, people working in just kind of their own thing. He says, you know, work together, get in each other's own way more. And if you do that, maybe we can make faster progress than we would have otherwise.
Does he have any other suggestions as to how to do that? Or did you hear anything today? Because we have heard that's one of the problems in the industry. Everybody covets their own research. And we've done stories about proposals to make a huge database.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there were some specific, pretty discreet initiatives that the government announced today. They're going to set up an oncology center of excellence at the FDA where all the oncologists that are kind of spread throughout the agency will work together. But mostly, he was just talking about changing a general culture of, you know, people kind of doing their own thing and maybe not even really being conscientious enough. One thing he mentioned was an investigative piece that STAT actually did last fall. My colleague Charlie Piller wrote about how cancer centers and other research institutions aren't reporting the results of clinical trials the way they're supposed to. And, you know, the government is supposed to be able to cut their funding if they do that, but it hasn't been doing that. So Biden said, you know, if this is true, I'm going to start cutting some funding myself. It's almost like he was raring to go, willing to take them on himself.
Well, he also pointed out advances, new treatments, immunotherapy, but said one of our biggest problems is the lack of affordable cancer treatments. Let's listen.
What is the possible justification when a drug, a life-saving drug, is brought to market? At the time it's brought to market, it cost $26,000 a year, and 15 years later, it cost $120,000. Tell me, what is the justification for that?
Well, and we can hear the anger, but is there any sense that anything can be done about that?
Well, this is a really, really big problem. It's not just with the price of cancer drugs. It's with, you know, a lot of new innovative drugs that are coming to market. But yeah, it's a big problem because the pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies would tell you that they have to risk so much investment to bring a new drug to the market. And it takes so long and it's so expensive that this is how they have to recover their costs. Now, there's a lot of cynicism about that. Like, do you really need all of that money? Does it really all go to research and development? Doesn't a lot of it just go to advertising? advertising instead. But I'm just telling you, that is kind of the party line that you get from the industry, and it's really going to be hard to shake them off of that.
That's been sort of a circular debate for a while now. Well, we heard Biden say that the goal is to double the rate of progress to achieve in 5 years what's now done in 10. First of all, how big a deal is that? And how would you measure that? I mean, like, what would the goals be?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we've ever gotten a clear system of metrics out of the vice president's office. I don't know how they're going to measure that. What they'll probably do is just, you know, every time there's a breakthrough that people, you know, kind of said generally was years off of the horizon, they can point to that as success. Right now, though, you know, the Biden's cancer initiative is too early to be able to point to any of that. I mean, they just got started at the beginning of this year. So all they can kind of point to is, look, we set up a center of excellence at the FDA and kind of little things like that. They're just trying to set the momentum so that maybe people will work together more and there will be actual breakthroughs down the road, but we might not see them for years.
Yeah. So changing the culture, changing how people share information. And one of the goals, making cancer a chronic disease rather than a deadly one. Imagine that. I mean, what was the mood in the room? Is there enthusiasm? Is there belief in that?
Yeah, you know, the mood in the room was really upbeat. There was a lot of applause. You know, people got pretty emotional listening to Biden talking about his son Beau, who died of brain cancer. And I've heard this, you know, outside of this session many times. The most optimistic people in cancer research will kind of tell you, no, it's not that we're going to end cancer. That, you know, that isn't going to happen. There's too many different kinds of cancer and so forth. But it might get to the point where you could actually manage cancer, and it does become more like a chronic disease. I mean, I've talked to the head of MD Anderson has its own cancer moonshots program, and that's how he looks at it.
David, from your lips, thank you so much. David Nather, Washington editor of STAT.
Thank you.